You are listening to a Bible talk recorded at the 2012 Toronto Fraternal Gathering. The speaker is Brother Mark Vincent, and this is the first address of his Young People series entitled God's Hand in the Life of Joseph, and this address is entitled What is Your Occupation? And this address was recorded on April 7th, 2012.
Well, hello everybody. What I'd like to do in these two sessions is to use a couple of... Can you just turn me down a little bit? Is to use a couple of the passages in the Joseph story as a springboard to talk about a couple of different things. And in this first talk, we're going to use this passage that we just read, in which Joseph settles his brothers in Egypt. And then in the second talk, we're going to use a passage right at the end of Genesis in chapter 50. But before we get into talking about the passage, I just want to take a minute or two thinking about the question of identity. Who are you? And how do you know that's who you are? Where do you get your sense of self from, your self-image? Now, that's actually quite a that's quite a big question, really. Everybody needs to have a sense of who they are. They, you know, you need to have self-respect, don't you? And at some level, a sense of pride in yourself. And what, in a way, what being in your teens and your early 20s is about is finding out who you are, isn't it? And it's about establishing your own identity as against the identity of your parents or the family in which you were brought up. So, in a way, when you're a kid, your identity is subsumed in the family unit that you're a part of, isn't it? And you take your identity by being the child of your parents and by living in a particular neighborhood and having a particular socioeconomic background and having a certain level of or lack of sporting abilities, intellectual abilities, social abilities, but largely you're part of that. Your identity is dictated to you by all these external things that you don't really have any control over. You can't choose your parents, can you? That's just how it is. But as you grow up into being an adult, clearly then you're now establishing your own identity and you're saying or working out, I want to be this type of person as opposed to that one. And that may involve embracing some of the things that you already had as part of your identity. It may involve rejecting some of those things. And sometimes, obviously, there's a certain amount of posturing that takes place, isn't there, in that period of me saying, no, this is who I am. I'm not one of those. I'm one of these. And I'm going to make sure everybody knows it. And it's quite interesting, you know, if you look at people's online identity, you can see people setting out, this is how I want people to see me. This is who I want people to perceive me to be. So let's think a little bit then about, you know, let's go on through the past the sort of identity formation phase of being a teenager and perhaps being in your early 20s to a stage a bit later on, perhaps when your identity is formed. What makes you you then? How do you know that this is you as opposed to someone else? And again, it's still those things in your history still have a big impact, don't they? The family that you were brought up in, your nationality, the place in which you live, the kind of socioeconomic group that you're in, the job that you do, the education that you had, the family that you now have, who you're going out with, who you're married to, whether or not you have kids, what sort of house you live in, all those things are part of your identity. Now, the scriptures have a lot to say about this question, and I think it's quite interesting that a lot of those elements that are key to people's sense of self, sense of who they are sort of turned on their heads in the scriptures and given a different slant, say, oh, well, there's actually a different way of looking at that. So, you know, we have a national identity. You're Canadian, I take it, most of you. I'm British. And, you know, I live in Scotland, and in Scotland there's this huge sense of, I'm Scottish and I'm not English. And, you know, there's a whole debate going on now about whether Scotland should separate from England in some way. And as an Englishman living in Scotland, I'm sort of watching that and thinking, I'm not quite sure how this is going to shake out, but it's probably not going to be good. So national identity can be very important to people. But of course, the scriptures take that idea of national identity, don't they? And they say, actually, I don't care about that. From God's perspective, it's an irrelevance whether you're Canadian or English or Scottish or wherever you're from, because you'll remember the verse where Paul says, our citizenship is in heaven. And if we seek to be disciples of Christ and to belong to God, and we're baptized into Christ, then our nationality is transferred, as it were. You get a new passport, don't you, effectively. And you're no longer a citizen of this country or some other country. You're a citizen of heaven. And that brings along with it, then, a set of principles that... I'm just a guest here. And obviously I am a guest here because I don't live here. But you're guests here too. You don't live here either, potentially. This is just a place that you're passing through. Just like Abraham and Isaac and Jacob were sojourners, strangers and pilgrims, as the AV puts it. So that's what we are then from a biblical perspective. We don't have a continuing city here. We're looking for a city that the Lord Jesus is going to set up when he comes back to set up the kingdom. So the whole concept of national identity then is transformed in the scriptures and made into something else. What does it mean to be a citizen of heaven? What does it mean to be a citizen of God's kingdom living here now in Canada? And, you know, it's a good exercise to reflect on that and to think about what that would mean then for the way in which we would live. So that's one aspect there, national identity. You take the idea of the family. So, you know, we've all got parents, or we were brought up in some environment. We probably have brothers and sisters, and that creates part of who we are. But what does the Bible say about that? Well, it turns that on its head too, doesn't it? You remember when the disciples came to Jesus? Jesus' family came to visit him, didn't they? And his disciples said, your mother and your brothers are standing without and they want to talk to you. And Jesus said, who is my mother and my brethren? The people who want to listen to God's word, those are my brother, sister and mother. Which is an interesting turn of phrase. And again, he's redefining the concept of family, which we do. When we call one another, when we're baptized and we call one another brother and sister, we're saying we're in a new family now, and our identity comes from that, actually, more than the fact that I'm a Vincent, and whatever that means. I'm actually part of a much bigger family, and that is more important in defining who I am. And we could sort of carry on along that vein. So we've thought about national identity, we've thought about family, the place where you come from. Well, I come from a small seaside town called Scarborough, made famous by the Simon and Garfunkel song, Scarborough Fair, which you probably may not know, or you may. Who knows that song? Oh, not bad, not bad. I feel more at home now. So that's where I'm from, but the Bible redefines that idea, doesn't it? It redefines that idea as we're all born in Egypt or in Babylon in a kind of way, and we've got to be saved from that, because being born from that place means that we're going to die, and there's not a huge amount to look forward to. But God can bring us out of that place and take us to another place. But I'll just do one more of these before we get to the main one. Another one would be education, wouldn't it? So I don't know what age you have to pick your subjects that you're going to specialize in at school and at college here. In the UK, I guess you make your first choice at around 14, I think. And you narrow it down to a couple of compulsory subjects, English and maths, and then you maybe choose another six or so subjects. And then when you get to 16, you maybe narrow that down to three or four subjects, and then obviously you specialize at university. And then if you stay in university, you specialize and specialize. And that's what I did until I became an expert, allegedly, in Psalm 68, which is what I wrote my PhD thesis on. Just on one psalm, and which is a kind of a crazy level of specialization, isn't it, really? And so our education can be defining of who we are, but the Bible, again, takes the idea of education and says, where is the wise person? Where is the learned person of this world? God has made the foolish things to confound the wise. The wisdom of this world isn't what it's about. There is another kind of education that's more important for your identity than what you happen to study or whatever level you happen to study it at. And that's what should be the focus. And of course, the Bible is the way that that's mediated to us. The final one, and now we're getting to Joseph and really the point I was driving at all along, is work. What you do. What your job is. And your job, obviously, takes up a huge... People keep throwing things down at me. I've got a bottle of water, now I've got a pen coming down at me. as long as you don't start throwing tomatoes, I'll be okay. So, you know, I leave the house at 6 o'clock in the morning and I get back at 6:30 at night. That's 12 and a half hours of every day. That's a huge amount of time, isn't it? That's the best of my waking hours, I suppose, that's taken up by work. So there's no wonder that people are defined by their work. And you meet some people who, when you talk to them, you realize there's actually not very much else in their life apart from their work. They're consumed by it, they're dominated by it, that is who they are, and there's not a whole lot else. Well, the scriptures take the idea of work and what our job is and transform that too. So let's get into the passage that we read together. So we started in chapter 46 and verse 31, wasn't it? And we go to 47 verse 12. Now I'd like you to have another look at that passage and just notice if... Well, what struck you about that passage? Did anything strike you about it? Just have a quick scan through it again. Is there anything repetitive about it? Those of you who were here yesterday, which I think is most of you, I'll probably recall that we kept noticing in the chapters we were looking at yesterday that many things in the Joseph story are repeated again and again, and that there's usually a point to that repetition. It's directing our attention towards something that we should focus on and think about. So did you notice anything repeated in that chapter that we read today? Any volunteers? The what?
Your title.
The title.
What is your occupation?
What is your occupation? Yeah, so where did you spot that? Excellent. Yep. So, verse 33, and it shall come to pass when Pharaoh shall call you and say, what is your occupation? Then ye shall say, blah, blah, blah. And verse 3 of 47, and Pharaoh said unto his brethren, what is your occupation? And they said unto Pharaoh, blah, 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 blah. So Joseph, just like Joseph's dreams predicted what was going to happen to him, so too here, Joseph is predicting what Pharaoh's going to do. And lo and behold, Pharaoh does exactly what Joseph said, doesn't he? So it's, in a way, Pharaoh's almost a kind of puppet of Joseph. Joseph's able to predict what he's going to do and how he's going to respond. And Joseph calls it very, very well. So yeah, what is your occupation? Now that's a good question, isn't it? What is your occupation? Because it's one of those double meaning sort of questions. Think about the word occupy. What sort of things occupy you? Well, I just talked about that's 12 and a half hours of every day of mine spent in some office. So that occupies me. It has to. I have to earn some food to feed, earn some money to feed my family and so forth. But does that really make me tick? Is that what drives me in life? Does it occupy me? It occupies me sometimes because things go wrong and I worry about them and I think about them and people annoy me and then I replay the conversations in my head of things that were said and what I should have said and didn't say and, you know, the sort of thing that we all do. So in that sense, work occupies me while I'm at work, and then sometimes it occupies me out of work as well, and I need to try and control that and not let it preoccupy me. But what is it that really motivates me, that really drives me on? And so the job that I do is I'm a portfolio manager. So I basically watch stock prices going up and down on a computer screen all day. And sometimes I buy them and sometimes I sell them. Some people who do that job love it. They can't wait to get into work in the morning to switch the computer on to see what's going up and what's going down. I actually don't love it. It's just something that I do. And in a way, having a job like that where you don't, I mean, there's advantages both ways, isn't there? If you have a job that you really love, then that's a wonderful thing in a way, because you spend so much time doing it. You know, if you like it, great. I don't dislike my job, but the fact that it doesn't really, you know, it's not what life's about for me, means that you're sort of not tempted to spend more time there than you need to, do you know? Which has its advantages as well. So what occupies your thoughts? What are you passionate about? What preoccupies you? That also makes you think of it. It made me think of the idea of being engaged. You know, sometimes you go to the toilet and it says occupied on it, doesn't it? And some toilets say engaged on them. And obviously the person inside is busy there, locked away. But that very idea of being engaged is sort of interesting as well, isn't it? Let's get back to that passage in 46 and 47. Is there anything else that's repeated? So you've picked up what is your occupation. Is there anything else that's repeated in there? Hi, yeah. Fire away. Okay, great. Jacob blessed Pharaoh. Yep, good. And then we got another one down here, sorry, at the front.
46 verse 32, shepherds. And 47 verse 3, shepherds. Both being our fathers.
Good. Any more shepherds? Yep.
Chapter 47, verse 9, the Israelites, him and his family as pilgrims, and twice until the beginning and the end of the verse.
Good. Yep.
And verse 4 of 47, the servant's flocks.
Mm-hmm. Yep. 46 verse 32. Did you mention that one?
Yes.
Yep. Good. And verse 33. Here's the word. Yeah, verse 34 is there again, isn't it? Our Father, thy servant's trade hath been about cattle from our youth. So there's a lot of references there then, particularly to being shepherds, isn't there? Now, so let's ask the question then. We've spotted this repetition, and we're going to want to go on and think, so why is this such a big deal? You know, why does it matter that they're shepherds, and why does the text keep repeating it? I mean, just think actually what happens in the whole passage. So first of all, Joseph says, I'm going to go and tell Pharaoh that you've come and that you're shepherds and that you've brought your flocks. Yeah, that's the first thing that Joseph says. And then he tells his brothers that when Pharaoh asks you what's your job, this is what you should say to them. Say to them that you're shepherds. And then Joseph tells Pharaoh that his family have arrived. So this is 47 verse 1. Then Joseph came and told Pharaoh and said, my father and my brethren and their flocks and their herds and all they have arrived. And verse 3 now is actually this presentation to Pharaoh. Verses 3 and 4. And then verse 5. Does anything strike you as odd about verse 5? Does this strike you as being redundant in any way? I think Joseph already knew that his family had arrived. Yeah? And now Pharaoh says to him, Joseph, do you know what? Your brothers and your family have just arrived. Yeah, you're right. Too right they have. I told you they were arriving. See, verse 5 and verse 1 are kind of in parallel, aren't they? Verse 1 is, Joseph told Pharaoh, my family and my brothers have arrived. And in verse 5, Pharaoh told Joseph, your family and your brothers have arrived. Yeah? Now, that is a bit odd, isn't it? Yeah? That's slightly strange. And the strangeness of it, then, is a kind of a clue. Oh, something's going on here. What is it that's going on? Well, there's a little pattern being set up. Do you remember we started yesterday by talking about Judah's speech? And do you remember it went ABC and then it went ABC again at the end and then there was a bit in the middle? Well, similarly here, there's a pattern going on. And you can see it where Joseph tells Pharaoh that his brothers arrived and then Pharaoh tells Joseph that they've arrived, and there's something in between. And so you see you've got a sort of A-B-A type pattern. Well, in fact, the pattern in that whole passage, we won't go through it now, because you basically need a piece of paper to kind of draw it out. But the whole thing from verse 13 or whatever it was that we read to verse 31 through to verse 12 of chapter 47, the whole thing is a huge A-B-C-D-C-B-A sort of pattern to it. And again, like I said yesterday, whenever you see a big formal pattern like that, there's usually a point to it. And the point here comes right in the middle. And that middle bit is verse 3 and 4. Well, verses 2 to 4. And Joseph took some of his brothers, even 5 men, and presented them unto Pharaoh. And Pharaoh said unto his brethren, what is your occupation? And they said unto Pharaoh, thy servants are shepherds, both we and also our fathers. They said, moreover, to Pharaoh, for to sojourn in the land that we come, for thy servants have no pasture for their flocks, for the famine is sore in the land of Canaan. Please let us dwell in the land of Goshen. So the very central bit then of that whole section is, Pharaoh asked them, what is their occupation? And they said, we are shepherds. And that's now no surprise to us, is it? Because we've already noticed that that question, what is your occupation, is repeated. And we've noticed that the idea of them being shepherds and of all this cattle being about, it goes right the way through the whole passage. We've noticed that it's a kind of a cumbersome passage, isn't it? With all this reference to Pharaoh's going to say, and you're going to say, and then Joseph says, and then Pharaoh says, all about the same issue. And it's cumbersome because it's in this great pattern that's leading us to this central point. What is your occupation? We are shepherds. Now, why is such a big deal made of this then? Has anyone got any ideas? Right. So a shepherd's an abomination to the Egyptians, and Joseph wants the brothers to kind of make it plain to Pharaoh. Is that what you're saying? That's what they are. Sort of, we are what we are. I haven't read it like that. You mean in the sense that verse 34 doesn't mention the word, doesn't include the word shepherd in the first bit of it, do you mean?
Yeah.
Right, okay. Okay. That's interesting. Now, I need to think a bit more about that then, and where that would take us. Well, let's think about the fact that they are shepherds. Yeah, what is your occupation? We are shepherds. Then, whether or not they should have, let's park the issue of whether or not they should have said that they were shepherds or not. Does anyone see anything ironic in the brothers saying that they are shepherds? Now, the idea of being a shepherd, when Jesus says, I am the good shepherd, what does he mean? He doesn't mean he is literally a shepherd, does he? He's talking about being a shepherd of people. Yeah, of the flock, of you and me, of being our shepherd. That's what the good shepherd is. And in the Old Testament too, shepherding is a metaphor. You know, obviously there's a literal job of being a shepherd, but there's the metaphorical shepherd, isn't there, of someone who looks after a flock and takes care of people, just as a real shepherd would take care of sheep. Now do you see something ironic in the brothers, in Pharaoh saying, what is your job? And them saying, we are shepherds. Well, they're not very good shepherds, are they? Because what happened? Well, they got a coat and dipped it in the blood of a goat and made their father believe that a wild beast had devoured their brother. Yeah? Now, isn't that exactly what a shepherd is supposed to do? A shepherd is supposed to prevent that happening. He's supposed to drive away the wild beast and even give his own life to protect the sheep. That's what a shepherd is supposed to do. That's what the occupation of a shepherd is. And Joseph now, I think, or this is how I'd read it, is making this huge play on the idea that the brothers are so-called shepherds, and yet they are failed shepherds. And what they need to learn is, you know, they know how to be literal shepherds. Sure, they've done that since they were boys. But what they don't know is how to be spiritual shepherds, as they illustrated when they drove the family apart by what they did to Joseph. They've been terrible shepherds, haven't they? You know, what is your occupation? We are shepherds. Oh, you are you? Well, you better start acting like shepherds then. And that's the lesson that they've had to learn through all this. Yeah.
I think there also might be a secondary point there when they say that they and their fathers have been shepherds. Because we can also see that Jacob hasn't been terribly successful in controlling his family. Mm-hmm. His family's gone astray every which way, pretty much every opportunity they've had.
That's good. Yeah. 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 Now, of course, Joseph and his brothers were not the only people who were shepherds. Who was the first shepherd in the scriptures? Anybody know? No. Almost. His brother. Let's have a look at it, shall we? So this is Genesis 4, and verse 3 and 4. Now, what was wrong with Cain's offering? Wasn't what was required. And that's an assumption, isn't it? I mean, it's a good assumption, but it's an assumption. In what sense was it not required? Or not what was required? Yep.
Blood.
Excellent. Yep. So in verse 4, you have Abel's offering, and it's described as he brought the firstlings of his flock and of the fat thereof. And you've got three F's there, haven't you? Firstlings, flock, and fat. And I think each of them probably has a point with it. So it was the first then, wasn't it? So the principle is, what do you prioritize in life? Do you prioritize your job, for example? Do you prioritize your education? Do you say, well, I'm just going to do this. You know, I'm just going to work hard for these exams, and then I'm going to think about my responsibilities towards God. Or, you know, I'm just going to work really hard until we get to live in that kind of house, and then I'll have some time to put some energy into ecclesial life, for example. Or do you say, I'm going to take care of things to do with my spiritual life first, and the other things fit around that? What do you put in first place? And my experience has been that whenever you say, I'm just going to do something else first, and then I'll worry about my relationship with God, it never works. And once you allow something else to be in there first, there's always something else that comes in that says, well, I'll just do that, and I'll just do that, and I'll just get a little bit further, and then I'll get round to it. And somehow it never quite seems to happen. Whereas if you flip it the other way and say, well, I'm going to do first things first, I'm going to try to seek first the kingdom of God, then other things in life fit around that. And here, then, Abel brings the firstlings of the flock, and that's to your point, then, about this was an animal, it was a flock, this was a sacrifice, then, the shedding of blood, and he brought the fat thereof, and this was obviously a time, fat is obviously regarded as with negative connotations today, isn't it? And we want fat-free things and the light mayonnaise rather than the heavy one. But in Bible times, it was the opposite, and the fat was the best bit, wasn't it? And that was the bit that you wanted. I used to go to Russia for Bible mission stuff, and I remember once being given some brown bread, and swine fat was how it was described, and that was the meal: a brown bread with swine fat spread on it. And they considered this as being a nice meal, which I struggled with, especially because some of the swine fat had the hairs of a pig poking out on it. It was a little tricky, but we got through it. My wife used to be a vegetarian, so she did particularly well to survive that. So again, this was the best bit then, wasn't it? And in contrast, Cain brought the fruit of the ground. So I just wonder, you never quite know quite how far to go with, when you analogize things and when you see these things as a metaphor. But Cain's job, effectively, was to be concerned with living things, wasn't he? He was a shepherd, and Abel's job, did I just say Cain there? Abel's job was to be concerned with living things. And Cain's job was to be concerned with inanimate things, like carrots. No, Cain was concerned with those. And we live in a world, obviously, that is very concerned with things, don't we? Material things, and having more and bigger and better and things and better brands and so forth. Materialism is the god of our age, I think, that's the thing that's pushed down our throats all the time by media, and that's the reason why media ad budgets are so big as they are, because they work and they do make us focus on things. But we ought to be shepherds then. And what does a shepherd do? Well, a shepherd is concerned about his flock. He protects his flock. He looks out for his flock. He potentially gives his life for his flock. He feeds his flock. He nourishes his flock. He looks out for dangers that might come to the flock and tries to avert them before they happen. And so that's quite interesting then, isn't it, when we think about our own responsibilities. Now, so let's come back to this question then. What is your occupation? The Lord Jesus Christ told a parable in which he went away on a long journey and came back again. And what did he say? He said, "Occupy till I come," didn't he? And that's what we have to try to do. We have to find the right things to occupy our minds, our energies, the right focus for our motivation. And I think we can learn a lesson from this point that Joseph is making. Joseph is focusing, this whole passage focuses in on the fact that the brothers should have been shepherds. And that's what we should be, in the sense of the most important thing is our relationship with God, obviously, and then our relationships with other people. And that's those, of course, are the first two commandments, aren't they, about loving our neighbour and loving the Lord our God. Looking after people, looking after one another and one another's spiritual health is tremendously important. That's what the brothers failed to do, and that's what Joseph made them realise was so important. I want to I want to perhaps finally in this session just think a little bit more about this idea of our occupation and how the scriptures transform our way of thinking about it. Now, imagine a conversation like this, that goes like this. So what do you do? Well, I work in my father's business. All right, what does your dad do? Well, he's the creator of the whole world. And that would be an odd conversation, wouldn't it? But there's a point there, isn't there? And it's a point that Jesus himself makes. Let's have a look at Luke 2 as our last passage. So in a way, you know, there are all sorts of considerations, you know, when we think about what is our job going to be, literally our job going to be, there's all sorts of considerations for that, aren't there, about, you know, perhaps wanting to try to help people by what we do, finding a job that's going to enable us to support a family, perhaps, or finding a job that is going to give us perhaps free time to dedicate to spiritual things. But there's also a sense in which it doesn't matter what we do, as long as what we really do, what really occupies us, is these higher things of God, and that is our occupation. And, you know, I just happen to be a fund manager, but what really occupies me is something else, and that's what my identity comes from, and that's what my real focus is on. So this is Luke 2 is, of course, when Jesus was in the temple, and his mum and dad left, and in verse 47, is it 7? 8. And when they saw And when they saw Jesus, they were amazed. And his mother said unto him, Son, why hast thou thus dealt with us? Behold, thy father and I have sought thee sorrowing. And Jesus said unto them, How is it that ye sought me? Wished ye not that I must be about my father's business? And of course, business is a word to do with occupation, isn't it? What is your business? What do you do? I do my father's business. Now, that's quite a line of work, isn't it? That's something else. You know, I've spoken to a number of brethren recently who've retired, you know, a few years ago, and I say, do you ever are you in touch with anyone that you worked with? And I said, no, not really, not anymore. And so soon after you've gone, nobody scarcely remembers you. You know, you might do a job for 50 years working in the same company. Not that, I mean, people obviously generally don't do that now, do they? Because, you know, people chop and change jobs much more. But all that work, all that effort, and it's so quickly forgotten. I remember a brother once telling me how there was someone at his work. It was their last day, and it was they were having a presentation, you know, sort of, thanks for all your hard work, here's a clock to put on your mantelpiece, well done, off you go into retirement type presentation. And before he left, what he wanted to do was, he had one last project that he'd wanted to plan that the company was going to be doing over the next year or so, and he prepared this document setting out what he thought needed to be done for this project and the sort of to-do list, and he went around and put a copy on everybody's desk. And that was like his last gift to his company as an employee. And then it was 3 o'clock, and so, right, everyone go to the presentation. So they go to the presentation. And while the presentation is going on, they're saying, you've done such a great job for the company. Here's the clock for your mantelpiece. Someone else was going round all the desks that this guy had put these pieces of paper on and collecting them all up and throwing them into the trash. You know, the world really doesn't care very much about all that work that we put in there. So, yes, we should do things to the Lord, certainly in our work, but our work shouldn't be either the basis of our identity or the main focus of our attention. And the Lord Jesus Christ emphasizes that here when he talks about work on a whole different level. My meat, Jesus said, is to do the will of my Father and to finish his work. So let's break there, and then we'll talk about another passage from Joseph shortly.